The field of mental health counseling is growing rapidly, and Richmond Graduate University can equip you with everything you need as a licensed professional counselor while integrating your faith into your clinical practice. Programs are offered in Atlanta, Chattanooga, and online. Apply today at richmont.edu. That's richmont.edu.
I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells,
about residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there,
and the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle, stories about life on the inside told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi, this is Dennis O'Hare, and before we begin this edition of The Political Breakfast, just a quick reminder, WABE is dedicated to providing you complete, in-depth coverage of the coronavirus pandemic and everything else going on in our Atlanta area and the world. And your support is more vital now than ever. In fact, 84% of WABE's financial support comes from the Atlanta area community. And the fact that you're listening to this podcast is a sign that you value the insights and the context you get from Political Breakfast and from all of the programs and podcasts that WABE offers. So in this, our spring fund drive, please consider making a gift of support if you can. Every gift helps keep us going for you. Please give at wabe.org/donate, and thank you. Just days after Georgia's Attorney General announced a state investigation of how local authorities responded to the February killing of an unarmed young black man near Brunswick, two suspects are in custody, the U.S. Justice Department is called in, and some top state leaders are getting behind a hate crimes bill. Meanwhile, Governor Kemp extends some pandemic response measures and partially lifts others, and some Republican polling predicts close battles with Democrats in the November elections, even as we scramble to make preparations for them. We welcome you to this edition of The Political Breakfast. I'm Dennis O'Hare, joined again by Republican strategist Brian Robinson and Democratic strategist Theron Johnson. Gentlemen, welcome back. Hope you're safe.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Almost immediately after State Attorney General Chris Carr announced the state would investigate the shooting death of Ahmaud Arbery, an unarmed young black man, by two white men near Brunswick, we had two suspects in custody, the U.S. Justice Department was brought in, and an outside prosecutor was appointed to handle the case. That prosecutor is Cobb County District Attorney Joyette Holmes. Theron, in our last podcast, you called for the appointment of an outside prosecutor. Did the Attorney General really have any choice here?
I think Brian and I showed that our level of understanding but relationship with the Attorney General, I think, sort of helped in this process. I mean, we're not going to take full credit for what he did, but I know Brian had some communications with him. I had a little bit of communications with his office and the AG as well. And one thing I would tell you, Dennis, in talking to Attorney General Chris Carr, he showed a level of understanding. He was very open to the idea. And so fast forward, he has chosen a very qualified district attorney in Cobb County that can lead this. But I want to say this. This is a good first step. But I do think that while you do have this special prosecutor, she's going to need an experienced team. So I would encourage them to look at other people in the region, other folks in the state that can add on to the team that this district attorney is going to need to hopefully bring justice. And then lastly, Dennis, I will say this. I think that if you look at how swiftly the GBI and the Attorney General acted, that was really good. They were to be commended. But I've been talking to a lot of folks in Brunswick, and Dennis, there are people on the front lines that have been for over 2.5 months trying to bring justice. And so I don't want the state's involvement to overshadow the tireless work that has gone in from local leaders, down in Brunswick and those surrounding counties that have been demanding justice for Ahmaud Arbery for many, many months now.
Also on our last podcast, I wondered whether the Attorney General and even the governor might face questions about why it took so long, and it took the leak of a video of the shooting to get state officials to intervene when two local district attorneys had already recused themselves. It's kind of an obvious sign that there were problems. Brian, the Attorney General, told the Atlanta Journal-Constitution he didn't even see the video until the rest of us did. Is that enough of an explanation, though, since there were signals that something wasn't quite right there?
Again, the state has had its focus on COVID-19 during this entire period, so it is not shocking to me that they had not seen the video. In fact, I spent some time with the Attorney General this week, and he found out about it because someone tagged him in a Facebook post. So that was how it got to him. And I heard a similar story from the governor's office. When the video came out, staff showed it to him, and the governor said, "That's awful. We have to do something." He reacted immediately. The AG said something that was also interesting to me to show you how routine this is. His office gets hundreds of these recusal requests every year. And so they're aware of the process of a DA recusing themselves and asking this to be sent to some other district attorney. They don't get necessarily bogged down in the details in the evidence that is in these hundreds of cases that they deal with every year. So I think that's part of the explanation. What we do know is that when confronted with the evidence, even really before there was, you know, a statewide or national outrage, they stepped right up. They didn't wait to see where the wind was blowing. They immediately took action. And as you mentioned, Chris Carr this week went so far as to do exactly what Theron Johnson called for last week. He appointed not just an outside prosecutor to look at it. It is an African-American woman prosecutor. It's exactly what Theron said we needed.
But what's very interesting to me is I talked to the folks down in Brunswick, and I want to make sure I get this correct. So when the Glenn County DA recused herself, they then had to appoint a new person. I think this was the Waycross DA. And then it went to the third prosecutor, which was the Liberty County DA. And now you have the Cobb County DA. But in between the Glenn County and Waycross DA, my question is, and I don't know the answer to this, and maybe Brian does, was the AG office not communicated with when you had to appoint a new DA when the first one, when she recused herself, or did he not know all of the evidence that was presented, including the tape, when he, I think his office was involved in appointing the third DA? And the reason I raise this question is, I believe the Attorney General when he says that he got tagged on Facebook and that he didn't see the video, but the one thing I think is still a little unclear is, was the video present in the evidence that was presented to the Attorney General's office when his office was involved in appointing the second and third district attorney on this case? I think that's something that I think to me is still just a little unclear.
And Brian, before you answer that, let me just set this up for our listeners. The original prosecutor was Brunswick DA Jackie Johnson, and she recused herself because one of the suspects, Gregory McMichael, had recently retired from her office. The next prosecutor was Waycross Judicial Circuit Attorney George Barnhill. He eventually recused himself too, but not before he had written a letter first saying that he thought Gregory McMichael and his son Travis were within their rights. Brian, I think the Attorney General has said that that video was not included in the original package that he got. I just wanted to check with you to see if that's right.
Yes, I had that conversation with Chris Carr this week, and he said in these cases, again, I think he mentioned it's over 700 cases a year, they don't get a book of evidence that someone in the law department of the state then pours through and makes a judgment about whether or not the DA has looked at everything appropriately and made the right decisions. Their job is to look at the recusal and then find someplace else to put this case. That's the role they play in that process. They are not the investigators in these cases. And once it rose to the level of their attention that there was something amiss here, they did step in. The governor stepped in, getting the GBI involved. Carr stepped in and got the DOJ involved as well. or at least I believe he's made the request. I don't know if they've accepted that. The DOJ, of course, doesn't comment on that type of decision-making process until they've made a decision. So, yeah, that's the deal.
So I'll throw this out to both of you then. Doesn't this raise the question, first of all, of whether material was withheld from the attorney general by either one or both of the district attorneys who recused themselves? And secondly, with that second DA, George Barnwell, writing that letter to the next person in the chain saying you don't have to do anything, Gregory McMichael and his son Travis were within their rights, doesn't this raise bigger questions for the governor, the attorney general, and perhaps the legislature about how justice is administered in some parts of the state?
I believe that Chris Carr has been very clear that he has concerns about how this case has gone down and its wider implications. What George Barnhill got this week for his that opinion that he put out saying that these guys were within their rights was a rebuke from a National Association of District Attorney. And so that is part of why Chris Carr has called for the Department of Justice, this federal entity, to come in and to study those very issues that you're talking about. How did this come about? What was the process? Was there any mishandling of this? How did we get to this opinion where you have a DA recusing himself, but at the same time putting out an opinion saying that the potential suspects are well within their rights? I think that that's what Carr is doing. He is looking into it. He is digging in, and he's doing it with an outside entity that should have credibility here.
And I think that the way you just framed it, Dennis, is exactly why you see the attorney general sort of over communicating with the public and sort of doing exactly what Brian just described. But the other thing that's really concerning here is it's not so much that the video existed. It's not so much that people who were investigating this incident, this murder, saw the video. It wasn't until we saw the video, Dennis, that these folks had to take action. This was going on since February 23rd, and you had local leaders in Brunswick and those surrounding counties demanding justice, demanding that this process be handled transparently. And it wasn't until the world saw that video when you start seeing state and local and national officials start to act on this case. And so I think that the attorney general understands that Georgia is in the spotlight, and he has got to continue to be as transparent and as open about this case. And more importantly, this new special prosecutor, the Cobb County DA, again, I think needs an experienced team around her because this case is going to be going on for some time.
Yeah, and look, I think that in the bigger picture here is there have been a lot of local accusations and finger pointing down there in the Brunswick area for some time having to do with police misconduct. And of course, the Jackie Johnson, the Brunswick DA, has said on the radio down in South Georgia this week that she feels like she's getting pushback because she's been raising questions about that misconduct.
And as we mentioned, the state attorney general, Chris Carr, has asked the U.S. Justice Department to get involved. Of course, U.S. Attorney General Bill Barr has been at the center of a lot of controversy about other things over the last few months. So, Theron, this is the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department. Do you expect Bill Barr, perhaps because of the controversy surrounding him in so many other areas, to take a hands-off approach and just let the Civil Rights Division do its thing?
Well, we have to wait and see. And I think that's why you saw Attorney General Chris Carr sort of utilize his experience in being in politics for a long time in Georgia. He knew that as the state attorney general, he had to get out in front of this quickly and become the voice of requesting the assistance from the federal Justice Department, because there are some concerns about the U.S. Justice Department's ability to fully investigate crimes like this one, particularly in the Civil Rights Division. And so I think what you're going to see is Attorney General Barr look at this case very closely. But I think as long as he can, State Attorney General Chris Carr wants to be the face of this, because on the Democratic Party, particularly, there are some concerns about a lot of cases that Mr. Barr has handled. So I think what they're trying to avoid is elevating Georgia into a national conversation about the Justice Department. But I do think they're going to have a role to play. I just think we have to wait and see how extensive that role will be.
I think it would be highly unusual for the Attorney General of the United States to weigh in on a local case like this. this is something that the career prosecutors need to handle, that these divisions within the DOJ need to handle. You know, where Barr has spoken out and been involved are issues of national importance or issues of national interest. And that's certainly the case with what's happening with former General Michael Flynn and the decision to drop the case against him. This is different. I think the appropriate thing is to let the machinery of the Justice Department work and let the facts lead them where they may. I know the president has been asked about this and made comments, and there's nothing that he has said that indicates he's going to want to get personally involved, and maybe the AG will take a cue from that.
Speaker Ralston got behind the idea of a hate crimes bill, which has already passed the House. It is stuck in the Senate right now. He urged the Senate to take it up and pass it without any amendments once the legislature does get back together. Just very quickly, Brian, your thoughts on whether that's going to happen?
You're certainly seeing some momentum build for it. You obviously had the speaker's comments this week. The governor has expressed his openness to it. I heard the attorney general say this week that he's open to looking at anything that would prevent another case like what we've seen in Brunswick. So you're seeing a lot of Republicans speak out on this. It passed the House fairly easily. Now, that said, there has not been a lot of, we got this covered talk coming out of the Senate. So we'll see if the political will or desire is there in the Senate. They have not said at this juncture. That'll be in the committee of outgoing Senator Jesse Stone, who's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. Not being on the ballot this year sort of frees him up to just kind of do wherever his conscience leads him to go. We don't know just yet where his conscience is on that, and we don't know where the lieutenant governor is on that or the majority leader or President Pro Tem is. So we still need to figure out a whole lot more because, you know, you're going to need a majority of the Senate caucus the Senate Republican caucus to come out in favor of it in order for this to get traction.
I want to commend Speaker David Ralston for his comments and his commitment to sending a signal, which is a strong signal, that we need to have a robust conversation about a hate crimes bill in Georgia. I don't know if the no amendments and no delay is going to be totally received very well in the Senate. As Brian mentioned, we have to wait and see. I do know that there is going to be a comprehensive review of the bill, and the questions that are going to be asked are, does it go far enough? Is it something that, you know, we feel that we need more of or less of in this bill? Because we only got one shot at this. Because again, Georgia was one of the few remaining states that does not have any type of hate crime law. And so I think you'll see Democrats and Republicans have a very open discussion about this, making sure that it's clearly defined, making sure that it follows the law. But you are going to see, I think, members in both parties want to question, is this the right bill? Do we need to enhance certain things in it? Do we need to take out certain things? And so that's when you're going to see the ability for legislators to negotiate. But I think, again, it's just a first step, and we need to make sure we see it all the way through.
And I can tell you this, I'm already seeing that outside groups are mobilizing around this issue going into June when the General Assembly will reconvene. You're going to see the business community come out in favor of passage of this and at least voicing their support explicitly. And you may see some third parties engage and spend some money on this to educate the public and try to get some kind of a grassroots demand that people call their legislators and ask for this. So on the flip side, the people who would be against it probably don't have an organized effort brewing right now because there's no funding source for that. So I do think those forces coming together are going to help raise the visibility of this issue and make it a major topic of those last remaining legislative days.
Let's move now to the continuing state response to the coronavirus pandemic. The governor extended the ban on bars, clubs, and theaters reopening, at least until the end of the month, but he lifted some more restrictions on restaurants, and he emphasized that part of the reason for this is the availability of critical care beds is much better. He also allowed summer camps to open as long as they abide by safety rules. How can the state rely on the administration for a unified plan and guidance for things like summer camps?
Well, I do know, I believe this is the case. My wife told me last night, actually, that the governor has continued to ban overnight summer camps, I believe. So there's a little bit of difference in how they're approaching some of these things. I think both the Trump administration and the Kemp administration, as well as the other 49 states, are having to balance the economy, the politics of all of this, and the health repercussions. And we're on our feet a little bit now. You know, we have some of these industries that were hard hit that have now put in safety precautions. You've got these long-term care facilities, nursing homes, that now have the testing that they need to contain the virus, increasingly getting the PPE that they need there and in hospitals. There's still some gaps. Obviously, there's still some problems. There's inconsistency in the testing data that we're getting. It's hard to kind of keep track in real time of what's happening. But I will say this, this is an important thing. When we reopen the economy, there's going to be a spike in cases. Now, granted, maybe it's going to take another couple of weeks to see it. Maybe that prediction was right. But for now, we're not seeing a spike in cases. We're seeing it much more contained. And part of it is because we have a lot of the resources that we needed that we didn't have 2 months ago.
You see a governor now saying he wants to continue following the CDC's recommendations, but we have to listen to our health experts. You know, if our economy can't survive with people being healthy and safe, then it's not an economy, to me, worth throwing all this support in right now. And I want to be clear what I'm saying. I'm all about reopening the economy in a phased approach. But Dennis, here just in the metro area, 83% of the people that are in the hospital are African Americans. We know we're still having deaths in metro counties like Cobb, I think, where we almost had pretty close to double digit, if not double digits, deaths in just 1 week. And so I just believe that we've got to continue to follow the medical experts, begin the process of a phased approach, reopen the economies. And I do think that we're going to continue to evolve in that aspect.
Theron, Atlanta Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms told CNN that she doesn't think that the state is really ready to go back to normal, as she put it. Her words were, "My concern is that we've gone back to normal and there's nothing normal about where we are with COVID-19. But the governor has not given local governments back, if you will, the ability to impose their own restrictions if they're stricter than the states. So is the mayor simply saying, look, I don't like it, but I don't expect to ever have the autonomy that I had a few weeks ago?
I think what the mayor is saying, Dennis, is that she's made it very clear that she has concerns about the governor's announcement to begin the process of reopening the state. She has been consistent in her messaging, following the data that she is receiving, that it shows that we are not at a point where we should be in this phase of reopening. A lot of people are trying to create this sort of battle between the mayor and the governor. Clearly they disagree, but it's not to the point where it's become so combative. So ultimately, I think you'll see her continue the process of doing what she can within her local authority to make sure that people are safe and that we start in a phased approach to reopen the economy here in Georgia.
Yeah, I'll tell you, oh, Mayor Bottoms, one thing that I would note as an outsider, you know, Theron is an insider with Keisha. I am not. She is still, despite repeated requests on this show for her to take me to lunch, Theron said he was going to do something and it hasn't happened.
It's going to happen.
Here's the thing. She has been on national TV, the cable news networks, more than our governor. And so she has made herself a national figure. She has made herself somebody who is really injecting her comments into the water table on this topic. What I wonder, again, as an outsider, is she using the focus on Georgia to raise her profile for her outside bid to be the vice presidential nominee? You know, she was an early Biden person. She stuck with Biden through the hard times. Is this part of a broader campaign? I mean, obviously, it's much more subtle than what Stacey Abrams is doing, which is, hey, pick me. I would be awesome. Literally, that is literally her talking points. Keisha's doing it much more subtly, the way that's much more preparable. And so that's something we need to keep an eye on. Is there a bigger strategy here that has nothing to do with the response to COVID-19?
The answer to Brian's question is there's no collusion. There's no coordination between her speaking up and speaking out on this COVID-19 process. I'll even be more specific, Brian, because you're right, I am an insider when it comes to the mayor. The minute that we saw the coronavirus uptick, you saw a mayor standing shoulder to shoulder with the governor at a press conference. They were together. He appointed her on his task force. She was given the responsibility of dealing with the homelessness issue. But where you saw reporters start calling her, not her reaching out to these reporters, is when Georgia was thrusted into the national spotlight, international spotlight, quite frankly, because I have friends in Europe saying, hey, I can't believe you guys are reopening. Then the mayor was given an opportunity to respond. And quite frankly, Brian, you know this, you're a PR expert. She just did a phenomenal job.
Real quickly to both of you, Brian, I'll start with you. Given the fact that, as Theron mentioned, we continue to see, even through a recent study by the Morehouse School of Medicine, how disproportionately COVID-19 affects communities of color, why not, if you're Governor Kemp, give Mayor Bottoms and perhaps other mayors in the state a little more latitude to impose their local restrictions if they're dealing with conditions that other parts of the state are not?
Well, I think part of it is because we're a mobile society. You know, one thing that I found fascinating, this actually hit the national news, is that data tracking devices, probably on our phones, showed that when Georgia reopened before our neighboring state, that the traffic from our neighboring states into Georgia to get a haircut, to maybe get a tattoo, I mean, that was like high on their list of urgent things to get done, spiked by tens of thousands of vehicle trips a day. So people are going to move, and if they're infected, take the virus with them to neighboring communities if there is a patchwork of regulations on the local level. So what Kemp has done is given us some uniformity. Now, granted, we're surrounded by states that we can all go to, but for the most part, people in Atlanta aren't going to drive to Alabama to get a haircut, but they might drive to Clarkston or McDonough to do it. So I don't know that a patchwork would even work.
I would say this again. I think, again, I have not spoken to the governor about this. He's not saying counties and cities, you can't come back to me with sort of recommendations of what you can do. I suspect that the governor and his team are talking to mayors and county officials. I'm not sure if the governor and the mayor have talked as of yet. I do know that particularly in DeKalb County, CEO Thurman said, hey, I'm just going to take it upon myself to build upon what the governor has put in place. I suspect that you're going to see more coordination as we move forward, because I think these mayors understand that they've got to work with this governor, but a governor also is going to have to sort of send a signal publicly that he is not only just open to suggestions, that that working relationship that we saw in the very beginning has sort of been engaged again in a very sort of public way. I do think that that will help ease some of the misunderstanding and tension that we see in our state.
And this dialogue could become even more important if we see a second wave of cases as we move through the summer into the fall and winter. Meanwhile, we already have a wave in our nursing homes. We'll take that up and a lot more when the Political Breakfast continues. Stay right here.
Support comes from Grady Health Foundation, presenting Move for Grady Saturday, April 27th, featuring a family-friendly bike ride through Atlanta's in-town neighborhoods. There's a ride, run, or walk distance for everyone, benefiting Grady Health System. More at moveforgrady.com.
And we are back on the Political Breakfast. Pleasure to have you with us. I'm Dennis O'Hare with Republican strategist Brian Robinson, Democratic strategist Theron Johnson. Brian, Governor Kemp, in his latest press briefing on COVID-19, said he was going to emphasize testing in nursing homes, that is already going on a big scale and it's going to continue to be ramped up, and contact tracing would be ramped up as well. But Andy Miller of Georgia Health News asked him a question: will nursing home owners be required to test their residents? And the governor said, our charge is to test him. And then he called on State Community Health Commissioner Frank Berry, whose department regulates nursing homes. And Commissioner Berry said, it's very difficult for us to force people to do that, so it's highly encouraged. I think we'll get a tremendous amount of cooperation. But isn't it true that there is indeed something the state can do? After all, it licenses nursing homes. And in New York, after releasing his guidelines for testing nursing home workers twice a week, Governor Andrew Cuomo said, if a nursing home operator does not follow these procedures, they will lose their license. Is the state as powerless as Commissioner Berry seems to imply?
the nursing homes around the state won't need to be strong-armed to test their residents. They are desperate to get the testing supplies that they need to test their residents. That's the only way they can know what they're dealing with. So you have seen the nursing home folks not being resistant to this. You've seen them begging for 2 months to get the PPE they need, to get the testing supplies that they need. You know, obviously, we are getting a big shipment of the swabs from the federal government that'll be distributed around the state. Obviously, the nursing homes are going to be a priority for that since their populations are so vulnerable once it spreads within one of those communities. So I don't think there's going to be any need for a hammer approach. I think this is going to be welcomed with open arms by these homes. Thank you for giving us what we need so that we can serve and save the people who live here, because that's our mission.
I have relatives who like to go visit people in nursing homes. And so this impact is not only affecting the people who are working or living at the nursing homes, but it has basically almost eliminated the ability for loved ones to go visit their family members or friends at a nursing home. And so I agree with Brian. I think there's got to be a special emphasis on nursing homes. I think when the session reconvenes, you'll see them focusing directly on nursing homes even more. And then the last thing I'll say is this, is that this is all about making sure that we have a full comprehensive plan to increase healthcare, and particularly the healthcare system in our state. And I think that for so many years, nursing homes have been talked about, but now is a prime opportunity to put our money where our mouths is on this and make sure that they can protect their citizens who are living there, but also have a plan going forward when we sort of see this spike that all of us are hearing about that could possibly come as soon as November.
Theron, the nursing home bill that has been already introduced in the legislature is probably going to be at least a subject of conversation when the legislature does get back together. Staffing is an issue in nursing homes already. Do you anticipate that we'll see this bill include higher staffing requirements, for instance, just to pick one thing? Because if you have supplies, you still need staff to be trained and use them.
Absolutely, Dennis. I think Speaker Ralston and Lieutenant Governor Duncan are probably talking to their members now about a lot of things. I mean, of course, teacher pay raises. I will put the nursing home bill up there in that top tier of priorities when the session reconvenes. And I do think what you just talked about is not just staffing, but also resources in having a plan going forward if we were to ever endure this type of pandemic again in the future. And so I think you'll see some legislators work in a bipartisan manner to enhance that bill as much as we can and get it passed.
We can't have an unfunded mandate on nursing homes. Now, let's remember that a lot of the funding for these patients comes from Medicaid, which is very low reimbursement. And so many of these homes work on razor thin margins as it is. Two, they are fighting desperately to get workforce now. I mean, they are out there trying to hire folks. Obviously, it's difficult right now. People are scared. In this industry and many others are scared of being exposed to the virus. So that's a challenge. So they're doing everything that they can to stay staffed up. So saying that they've got to have X amount of people working there when they can't find X amount of people to work there is a ridiculous mandate that will have no practical good or just create a bureaucratic hassle for these homes at a time when they're trying to make sure that this virus doesn't get inside the homes and protect and help recover those who do get it. So I think if we're going to approach it, it's going to have to be in a way of how can we help them get more workers? How can we incentivize people to be in this industry? How can we make sure that those workers are safe? And how can we continue to build on the efforts that we're seeing from GEMA and from the National Guard to go in and sanitize these homes and make sure that we are doing everything we can to kill the virus and stop the spread?
Brian, let me pick up on that point, because even nursing home industry leaders around the country are questioning the wisdom of reopening states too early, to come back to that. Wednesday evening on MSNBC, former Kansas Governor Mark Parkinson, who's now the president and CEO of the American Healthcare Association, said, if you open too early, you increase the presence of virus in the community. And in his words, if it's in the community, it's in the nursing homes. That was a real issue for him. He said to the states, please don't reopen so early, which brings us back to whether Governor Kemp and the state have the data they need to make that decision.
I don't know that we're doing long-term good for any industry, including the long-term care facility industry, by letting the economy crater any more than it already is. And, you know, that industry is dependent upon tax dollars. It is dependent upon tax revenue, and that depends upon a strong and thriving business sector, which we don't have right now. We are taking slow, methodical steps toward reopening. And one thing that we're going to have to be very careful about as we do is making sure that we continue to protect those people who are over 65 and have underlying health conditions.
But one way to protect them is to keep it out of the community, because even if they're isolated, you have the workers who have to come in and treat them. They're in the community. And if they pick up the virus, they could be asymptomatic for quite a long time and pass it on to the residents.
We could all stay home and never see each other for the next 6 months, and that would probably completely stop the spread of the coronavirus. We would also collapse the economy to such a degree that we would never recover. I mean, our food supply, which is already stressed, would stop. Our healthcare workers wouldn't be able to go and serve people who are sick with things other than COVID, people who have heart attacks and strokes, and that's not realistic. There's going to have to be some social interaction to keep our economy going to some degree. People's needs, human needs like eating and getting health care, continue. And we've got to be able to move forward in some way. We can't all just stay home forever.
You know, I think this is one that Brian and I disagree on somewhat. I think we agree that we want to have a phased approach to reopen the economy. But I do think you just got to follow the data. And the data completely shows it only takes one person to go to a facility, to go to a restaurant, to go to a nursing home, to go anywhere and not, number one, know that they have the coronavirus and spread it unintentionally to people. And while I'm a big proponent of people reopening their restaurants, I mean, my wife and I made it a commitment to support not only our favorite restaurants in this area that we live in, but also I've talked to a lot of restaurant owners who are saying we would have probably not reopened if we were not able to at least do carry out and take out. So I'm not suggesting that we all stay at home and don't go out for anything, but I do think that the quicker we can flatten the curve, do it in a way where people understand the rules and restrictions that the state and the cities and counties have implemented, and also make sure that we follow the data, then I think to me that's a recipe that we can sort of all follow to make sure that when this spike reoccurs, we will be able to flatten it quickly because we have now developed a practice of behavior that will help us get through it quicker.
Couple of political notes here very quickly. Brian, there was a stark warning from the state's budget chief this week that the state could blow through its rainy day fund pretty quickly, even though it's been built up over the years. Now, Governor Kemp was asked about whether there would be some form of revenue increase, or if you want to read it this way, tax or fee increase put on the table. He said he didn't want to speculate on that, and then he went into some of his priorities, like education, healthcare, and public safety, for when the legislature gets back together. But given that warning that we could blow through the rainy day fund pretty quickly, isn't it time to put everything on the table and at least see what the legislature will go for?
I think there's going to be a rigorous discussion on that. And I commend the governor for having the sense to not negotiate with himself when asked a question like that. He said, we'll talk about it, right? And that's the right thing to say in this situation. I want to say, as a Governor Deal person, somebody who was on his staff for a long time, he began building up that rainy day fund on the back end of the Great Recession. And believe me, there were many other things that we could have been spending money on, worthwhile things, politically popular things. There's not much that's politically good. There's no payoff to you to save money for later. Yet he did it anyway because it was the right thing to do. It was responsible. And I hope the people of Georgia express their appreciation to Governor Deal for what he has left us to use during this crisis. It's a significant amount of money that's going to keep teachers in the classroom, is going to keep policemen on the streets. that is going to do the essential services that are life-saving in a time like this. So we're going to have to look at everything that we can and make tough decisions, just like the ones that Governor Deal had to make during the Great Recession and the tough decisions he had to make to continue to save money rather than spend it, which is always the more politically popular and expedient thing to do. With a hole this deep, as bad as the Great Depression, they say, they're going to have to look at ways to raise money outside of income taxes or sales taxes. Those are going to be political dead enders. Nobody's going to want to go anywhere when it comes to like directly raising income taxes or sales taxes. We've discussed before the possibility of sports betting. I think that's something they may consider. I don't know that there's going to be enough time left in this session to really get something substantive done, but it's possible if crises demand extraordinary efforts sometimes. And of course, the tobacco tax, something that's been mentioned. I don't know how much of a push there'll be for that. But it doesn't matter in a sense that it's not going to stop the bleeding. There's still going to be tremendous cuts. This hole is not going to be filled with tax hikes. That would be terrible for our economy. It's going to be filled with spending cuts. And that means furlough days. It means not hiring positions that have had people quit or retire. And that could go on for several years.
I think all things are going to be on the table. I think you're going to see sports betting. Let's not leave out that the governor has asked for cuts, I think 14% across the board in departments at a time where, you know, you see many of these departments sort of operating on a very skeleton, very thin staff. And so I believe in a bipartisan way, this is when leaders have to be leaders. And you'll see some people come back with some innovative ideas about how we can grow the economy. But Brian is right. Governor Deal received a lot of criticism for building the rainy day fund, and he received a lot of praise for it. But thank God that he took that tough criticism and made those tough choices and put Governor Kemp and the state of Georgia in a good fiscal position. But now we got to figure out an alternative plan going forward to not only grow revenue, but also look at different tax options as well.
Let's shift very quickly as we wrap up from June to November. And there was some polling this week by a group linked to Governor Kemp that showed a couple of things. One, according to the poll, sitting U.S. Senator Kelly Loeffler, despite all the controversies in recent weeks, is, according to this poll, pretty much in a dead heat with her chief Republican rival for the Senate job, Congressman Doug Collins. It also showed that Matt Lieberman is the leader among the Democrats trying to get the job in that all-comers election. And it also said this is going to be a really tight year between Republicans and Democrats, up and down the ballot, including in the race for president. Now, that's a lot to chew on in one take or two. But Theron, let me start with you. Are Democrats feeling that confident that the state is that close, or do they think this poll may have missed the size of the job they have in front of them?
I look at this poll in two ways. One, it's a poll that's being conducted in May when we still have 5 months to go in the election. But it's also a signal to Democrats that the people who are spending the most money right now are Collins and Loeffler, and they're, from the looks of it, in a sort of statistical dead heat for first and second place, which sort of suggests that it could go to a runoff. I think that if you're in the Warnock campaign and you see that Matt Lieberman is where he is,
yeah, Raphael Warnock, you make the pastor of Ebenezer Baptist Church, who is also running.
Correct. You got to make a decision at a time where you raise the most money. How do you start spending it? But then if you're Lieberman, you're like, wow, you know, if this poll is correct, I'm in a good position. So how do I finish strong at a time where I know that my competitor is going to have a lot of money at the end? So it gives us hope. But again, everyone is trying to figure out how do we get out the vote in this COVID-19 era.
Brian, do you think that the Senate race is as tight as the poll seems to indicate?
Well, that poll was conducted by Glenn Boulder of Public Opinion Strategies. He's a well-respected pollster, someone that I have worked with in the past. He was Congressman Westmoreland's pollster, so that's where I crossed paths with him. But he also did work for Governor Perdue back in the alt years, and he did work for Jack Kingston in his Senate race in 2014. So he's got a long Georgia history, well-respected. A lot of questions are raised by the poll, though. We haven't seen the questions that were asked or the crosstabs, and those are something that you really kind of need to have a grasp on to give a real analysis of what it shows. I'm interested in the strategy behind why this came out when it did. Obviously, it cuts across this narrative that Kemp is underwater, that his approval rating is below his unapproval rating, by showing that Georgians support his efforts to reopen the economy in a gradual basis. And it shows that Kemp ally, Kemp appointee Kelly Loeffler, is in a much tighter race with Doug Collins than what previous polls, including one from the State House GOP caucus, showed Doug with a 30-40 point lead. I mean, something incredibly huge. So in the Kemp numbers and the Loeffler numbers, these are outliers from what we have seen from other sources. So for the reputation of this poll to stand, we're going to need to see another poll come out that backs this up, that it backs up at those trend lines. Because look, there's no way that Doug Collins had a 30-40 point lead 2 or 3 weeks ago and a 1 point lead today. One of these polls is wrong. And I'm not smart enough or in a position to say which one is wrong, but time will tell. And we're going to need to see more independent third parties weighing in with numbers to let us know where the truth lies. Maybe it's somewhere in the middle, but it is extraordinary to see the divergence that we see in these two numbers. It really makes you wonder if the methodologies, if the questions were very different in the two polls. And we don't know that just yet. So I think we need to be dubious of all numbers at this juncture until we see more consistency in what's coming out.
Two-part question to finish up for both of you. Do you think that the state is as close between the parties as the poll seems to indicate? And if that's the case, Brian, I'll start with you. Does that mean that some Republican candidates might have to consider how closely they tie themselves to President Trump, depending on what district they're in or what race they're in?
You know, it's really tricky because even in a swing district, you know, you look at the 6th district or potentially the 7th congressional district, where really on any given day, either party could pull out a victory in those seats. The Republican electorate that Republicans depend on to win, even in a swing district, are staunchly 90% plus pro-Trump. And they're not going to be tolerant of someone who is showing a lot of daylight between them and the president. That's a very tricky balance. I think to some degree you can talk about it differently, but if asked about your support for the president, you've got to be a strong supporter of the president. There's really no other way for them to move forward. And one thing that you're going to see people in those trickier districts do is talk more about local issues, talk more about representing this constituency and trying to localize it as opposed to nationalize it. Now, granted, the Democrats are going to try to nationalize it in every one of these swing districts and make Trump the major issue. Because let's be honest, whether you're running for dog catcher or U.S. Senate, Trump is the driving issue in every election across this country today.
Georgia is a battleground state. We saw a very competitive race here for governor in 2018 with Stacey Abrams, lost by roughly about 45,000 votes. And so what I'm seeing is that if we are able to have a message to the disaffected college-educated suburban white women who we saw in recent polling that are not as supportive as they once were of President Trump, have a base plus strategy where we can motivate our base, but also have a strategy in place where we can appeal to some moderates and these disaffected Republican white women voters, then I think that's our pathway to making Georgia blue again. But I totally agree with Brian that President Trump is the number one motivator on both sides. He motivates the Republican base like we've never seen before. He also motivates the Democratic base. So the challenge is that beyond Trump, as Democrats, what can we talk about? Can we talk about the economy? Can we talk about his response to COVID-19? Can we talk about healthcare? These are things that work in midterms. You know, healthcare, particularly with people with pre-existing conditions, was a big, big topic for Democrats. And also to bring it home here locally, Congresswoman Lucy McBath did a really good job of bringing a level of humanization to her campaign. She talked about healthcare, but she also talked a lot about gun control. She talked about responsible gun ownership. And so at a time where COVID-19 has sort of dominated everything that we read and we hear and we see, I do think by the time we get to November, you'll see Democrats have a message on some of the different issues that we believe that we can get voters to look at our party as the leaders on.
And that is it for this week's Political Breakfast. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Dennis O'Hare. Brian Robinson is a Republican strategist, communications consultant, and former Deputy Chief of Staff for Governor Nathan Deal. Democratic strategist Theron Johnson is a public affairs and government consultant and former National Southern Regional Director for the Obama 2012 campaign. Guys, thanks so much, and all the best to your families.
Thank you, and happy birthday to my wife.
Happy birthday.
And you can follow us on Twitter. Brian is at Lord Tinsdale, that's T-I-N-S-D-A-L-E. Theron is at Theron Johnson. And I'm at D-E-N-I-S-O-H-A-Y-E-R. And don't forget to catch WABE's newest podcast, Up to the Minute Information on the Coronavirus. It's called Did You Wash Your Hands? Sam Whitehead is your host. And if you like this show, please subscribe. You can do that, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. And be sure to rate us. That's a great way to make sure other people can find us. We'll be back in your feed and in your head real soon with more nourishing political conversation. Be sure to join us and have a great and a safe week.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you donated to WABE yet? I know you've heard us talking about why it's important, but it doesn't have to be this big decision. You can give at whatever amount fits your budget. It can be a spur-of-the-moment thing. You already get so much out of public radio, so just go for it. Visit wabe.org/donate and become a member right now. And thank you.